Welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Advancement and Mobilization for ABWE International, joined, as always, on this beautiful, crisp fall afternoon here in Pennsylvania by Scott Dunford, Vice President of Mobilization and Communications. People say spring has sprung. People don't really say fall has fallen, but I guess we could say fall has fallen here,
yes,
officially in Pennsylvania. I'm kind of surprised I didn't see you come into work wearing a sweater today.
I thought about it, but I am wearing plaid.
So. You're wearing plaid. You got the lumberjack look kind of going on right now.
It feels a little fallish.
It does, and it's nice. And we have someone else here with us in the studio enjoying some of this Pennsylvania weather. Scott, first of all, you know, as we think about, we're joking about the weather, but there's some places in the world that are very hot, that are very inhospitable climates. We talk about a lot of interesting parts of the world on this podcast, including some places that we can't always mention by name, because we're talking about front lines missionaries there in countries that are not overly friendly towards gospel workers. We're joined by someone who has experience in a place like that. I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah. So it was great to have with us Justin. He's a new friend of ours, served for years in Iraq as a missionary, and is now in the States doing something that we're going to talk about as well, aiding the cause of missions in a really unique way using the Ministry of Agriculture. He's the director of business development for FaithLink, and we're going to let him talk about that more. But Justin, welcome. And can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, how God led you into missions, and how you went from a farm in Kansas. We were just talking about John Brown's body. John Brown's mound. Yeah. Where you grew up, from farming in Kansas to serving in Iraq.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
Probably not something you thought about as a child growing up on a farm.
Oh, that's exactly right. Growing up in a very rural area in Kansas, where, you know, my home church was in a town of 67 people. We would have missionaries come through every once in a while. And I felt like that was something that you were born into. Loved to hear their stories, but just had no concept for seeing myself in a role like that. So it was a pretty radical calling for me. And being that our church was so small, we never had a full-time pastor. So we would have college students from nearby Bible colleges come, and we try to get them as freshmen and keep them for 4 years. And
wow.
I went to a small school in Kansas City my freshman year of college. And so I came home for church. And so I was the same age as our senior pastor. So we became really close friends. And at the end of his second year there, he just made an announcement to our church that he was going to Afghanistan, and just blew us all away. This was 2003. And so things were,
well, just 2 years after 9/11. Yeah, the military was there.
Afghanistan was not where people were going. So I met him after church and just challenged him as a friend, like in a really mature way. It's like, if you go there, they're going to kill you. And he challenged me by giving me a book. I think it was published by Operation Mobilization. Mm-hmm. And it was just a book of all the people groups in the world. Mm-hmm. And what percentage of them are following Jesus, and how many missionaries are going to them. And I was just reading through that. He said, read through this and pray through it. So I did, and saw Afghanistan, and just that stood out to me. And it's like, okay, I understand this. And he left and, you know, kept that book and got to Iraq, and just, God just put it on me. It's like, okay, I'll pray for Iraq. Okay. That's the extent of this calling. And so I did, I just started praying for Iraq. And that summer, just, I couldn't get it out of my head. Everything I did, I was working construction and telling the guys that I work with that weren't believers about, you know, just all these things about Iraq and what God was doing. And they just thought I was insane. And then, yeah, one day just was cleaning out my parents' barn, and God, every board I threw, it was Iraq or something. It just consumed me. And I stopped and prayed and just felt like I had confirmation, went to my parents. I was 21 or
single 20, at the time,
single 20. sophomore in college. I said, I think I'm supposed to go to Iraq. And they
naturally, your parents were supportive.
Unbelievably, they were.
Wow.
As a parent now, I was like, but they said, okay, let's pray about it. And then they're like, yeah, like I told them, they'd obviously been kind of tracking what was going on in my life. And they said, yeah, we think you need to go too. So
from Smallville, Kansas.
To Iraq. Somewhere Iraq. And didn't know how I was going to get there. Still, the thought of becoming a missionary didn't cross my mind. Hmm. So I started applying for I knew a little bit about construction. Hmm. I didn't know much about anything. I knew a little bit about agriculture. And then my view of Iraq was pure desert. So I was like, okay, I should probably lean into the construction side, 'cause I know they're, you know, rebuilding and there may be some opportunities. There weren't any. Mm-hmm. And then finally my buddy in Afghanistan told him what was going on, trying to get to Iraq. And he said, well, there's this organization that's sending people to Iraq and you should apply. So I did and got a call. And they said, I don't know if we're reading your application right. How many countries have you been to? None. I haven't left Missouri or Kansas. And how many Muslim friends do you have?
You'd never been outside the states of Missouri or Kansas.
One time. I went to Florida when I was in fourth grade.
Well, that
this explains why. And this explains why you said you were in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania for vacation, because I don't know anyone who comes to Harrisburg for a vacation.
Yeah, it explains a lot, probably. So... then the second question, how many Muslims, you know, it's like, I've never met a Muslim in my life. And they said, but you're called to go to Iraq. And I said, that's 100%. And they said, well, you sound like our kind of guy. And I'm like, well, what kind of organization is this sending me to Iraq?
Wow.
And, that's, you know, they had said, you got to wait till you're 21. So did that.
Fair.
Yeah. And, nobody was on board with this, but my parents, people thought I was crazy, lost my mind. Met up with my team and it was, I went with a great team, really diverse. They liked the joke because there was in all kinds of way diverse. We had a 65-year-old African-American lady from South Central LA who was a counselor. And then we had a 40-year-old Korean lady who was an engineer. And then a 31-year-old Chinese American guy who was a rocket scientist. He literally was a rocket scientist.
Wow.
And then they like to say, and then we got the redneck from Kansas. So there we were. And so second flight was to San Diego to train, stayed with Iraqi family for a month, dove into language 12 hours a day, culture, all that. And then they sent us to a little village on the Iranian border that was known for being fundamental Islam. We were the second foreigners, that's what they told us there, to show up. The first were special forces that went in before shock and all happened in Baghdad, because in the mountains surrounding this village is where Al-Qaeda trained. And
wow.
So, you know, it was 2005 and just poverty and no electricity, no running water, and half this town of 50,000 people. And we met with the mayor and said, what are your needs? And they just ripped off a huge list. And we're like, okay, what are your top three? And education, food, and health were the top three. And food, water were in that together. So, lo and behold, one of the things that they needed most was agriculture. And, everyone looked at me and I was not expecting that.
So it wasn't all desert then? It wasn't cactus farming?
No, where we were, was beautiful topsoil in this valley, in between these mountain ranges. And like, we just look at off the, you know, over the mountains as far as you could go, you come to Mount Ararat.
Wow.
It's like, this is the first valley, that you would come to.
Wow.
And the water table is 10 feet under the ground, black soil. You dig a hole, it fills up with water.
Wow.
Not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
Fertile Crescent.
Yes, exactly. And, I'm calling my dad, who's an agronomist farmer. It's like, you wouldn't believe this place. And he's like, I don't believe it. I don't believe that Iraq is the way you're describing it. So you drop a seed and it grows type situation. But people are starving.
Yeah.
What's the situation here? I mean, that's been, that question has been one that has really defined my career and our ministry and what I'm passionate about is why are people in places like this valley in Iraq with such good resources in Africa, same. So many of the places where poverty is highest in Africa is the same situation. You drop a seed out of your pocket and it's going to grow something.
So why? What is the reason for that that you found in Iraq? Because it seems like the solution would be plant some crops.
Yeah. There's a really good saying. There's an old proverb that we've all heard, a Chinese proverb. Give a man a fish, feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, feed him for a lifetime.
Man, yeah. Another American thing that ends up being actually Chinese. Everything's yeah. made in China.
Yeah. Well, a wise man once said, and this, when asked that question, that's not the problem. It's they don't have access to the pond. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what we've faced. Wow. I mean, they just don't have access to seed. I went to the seed bazaar to say, okay, let's start growing some stuff. 30-year-old genetics.
Wow.
That's a non-starter. You can't compete because agriculture is global. So if those farmers in that village were going to grow something, they have to compete with farmers in America. And if they don't have access to a bank to go purchase good inputs, then they're relying on what cash they have in their pocket. So let's say you grow corn, you're gonna make $500 an acre, but it's gonna cost you $300 an acre in inputs. If you don't have that $300, you're growing something else. Wheat, $80 to grow, $100, so a $20 profit. So you're 10x return. You can't play on that market just because of the finances. Secondly, the inputs, the quality, the access, and that's what he meant by access to the pond, access to financing and access to quality genetics and seed. So that's where I guess we'll get there a little bit later.
How are they, and I don't want to dive too deep into this before we ask some of the higher level questions too, but so how are they having to compete with American farmers for someone who doesn't understand a lot about the agro world?
They're competing with American farmers in that, these products, corn, soybeans, these commodities, they're used everywhere in the world. And,
Gotcha.
So if a farmer with 1,000 acres in America and great equipment and great seed,
so if Americans can make it and sell it cheaper,
then that's what we're finding. Chicken. I mean, all this is feed, this agriculture that we're, corn, soybeans, it goes to feed for, in Iraq, mainly chickens. And it's easier, it's cheaper to raise a chicken in America, freeze it, ship it across the world, put it on a truck, because Iraq's landlocked, or the Kurds where we were working at, ship it on a truck through these countries and distribute it amongst the people. It's cheaper to do that than it is to raise a chicken.
Wow.
In Iraq, because of a lot of these, a lot of the, farmers, if they're not going to grow corn and soybeans, if they can't do it profitably.
Until there's a disruption in the supply chain and now you can't get the frozen chicken delivered.
Yeah.
And you can't raise your own food.
Something like a war.
And then you're starving to death.
And that was the situation in Iraq. When we went in there, they said, we have a 2-week food bank. And we were with the Kurds in the north, who semi-autonomous from the rest of Iraq. And Bob Blinko likes to say, the Kurds are stuck between Iraq and a hard place. And it's very true. They're completely landlocked, surrounded by enemies.
Right.
And so the Kurds tried for independence when we were there. Referendum. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's so easy for any of those neighboring countries that have huge Kurdish populations to close the border.
Right.
2 weeks, no food. Are you sure you want to go through with this?
Yeah.
So agriculture, and that's really the nuts and bolts of why they said this is a priority for us. And, and why, our company, whenever we started it, and our company now, organization, there are no closed countries. It's yeah, there are closed countries to the missionary visas, but they're all open to business.
Say that again real loudly into the microphone, right? There are no closed countries.
There are no closed countries.
So there's no closed countries to God because he's sending people to every country and every people group in the world. But there's also no closed countries to agriculture because everyone needs egg.
Specifically in the 1040 window,
yeah,
where we struggle to send people.
Yeah.
And those countries, the overlap there is not only has the gospel not gone there like it has the rest of the world, but there's a high level of poverty. So whenever there's a high level of poverty and unengaged people groups, it gets our organization pretty excited to engage.
Well, you know, it may be hard for people to imagine this, but I think there's an illustration that highlights the importance of food, even to gospel proclamation. Have you ever tried to listen to a sermon at 11:55 and the preacher's got two more points to go and you know you're hungry? That's not even poverty.
Yeah.
But it's hunger that blocks your mind from even engaging what's going on. And so when people are starving to death, it's hard to hear the gospel.
It is, yeah.
So what happened? How did what you were doing with agriculture, did you see it open doors for the gospel in that place?
Really, at that time, it was more of a seed that was put in my head. Because I signed up for 6 months on that trip, and so the rest of my team. And God put people in our lives, local guys that were my age that just adopted me. I was walking around lost, you know, in the bazaar, and they said, join our group. And I did, and got to, you know, all kinds of opportunities to share the gospel in a place like that where you're the first foreigner they've ever interacted with. It's just natural questions. What do you think about our culture? Tell us about your culture.
Yeah.
What do you think about God? These are just natural questions whenever you're exploring, you know, something new.
Did they have preconceptions about Christianity at that point?
Yeah, some, but they were... Whenever you're faced with it, all of their ideas about Christianity are just the movies. Internet wasn't happening then, thankfully, probably, but that was their idea of what an American, and like obviously that was, you know, those types of movies very far from our team. And our team, we were all Americans, but we all looked, you know, so different. And so that was really hard. I mean, they had arguments like, you know, the Chinese American guy, I'm American. No, no, you're not.
it's like okay. The melting pot. Yeah. Everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, so those types of questions were common, and especially whenever they realized like, okay, I don't know much about America, and this is an opportunity to learn some more, ask some questions. So, you know, but always, what do you think about God was always one of those questions. So lots of opportunities there. One of the guys' dad was a mullah in town, very fundamental mullah, trained Al-Qaeda type mullah. And so anytime we talked about Jesus, he would shut it down, you know. But God works in mysterious ways, and it was just, I had this brilliant strategy to avoid him, and these other four guys were really open, but if he wasn't around, then I could probably get somewhere. But it was this guy and myself sitting on my porch one day, and just God put up my heart. It's probably the second time that God spoke the loudest to me. The first was go to Iraq. Second was share the gospel with this guy. And I did, and we talked for 3 hours. And he just the question, what do you have? What do you have, a CD? Do you have a book? What else? Give me more. Where can I learn more about what we're talking about? And we had New Testaments in their language, so we brought those in, and I had another brilliant idea where I got together with my team and said, "Where should we start?" And it's irrelevant where that point is, because I flipped there, and he said, "Why are you starting in the middle? Let's start at the beginning." I was like, "Oh no, genealogy of Jesus. This is gonna not be I'm gonna lose him."
Yeah.
And but you know, again, God just showed up, and at the end of that, he's like, "Wow, Jesus is really important." As a Muslim guy,
son of Abraham.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Going through his genealogy. just really spoke to him in a way that it didn't speak to me the first time I heard the genealogy, but from a Muslim background, okay, Jesus is different than what I thought. So moving forward from there, he invited the other guys, long story short, at the 6 month mark, these group of five guys were baptized and,
oh my gosh, praise the Lord.
Yeah. And, team left the next day. And I was like, I can't, like I was a sophomore in college. I had no responsibility on planet Earth. So like, I can't dunk them and dish them. So I was like, I'm staying. So stayed for another 6 months. They multiplied, very fruitful, to about 30 people following the Lord. And dude, Jesus was a buzzword in town. A lot of interesting things started happening. Al Qaeda showed up because it was election time and they thought that the best way to win the election was to find those campaigning and shoot them up. So it was a really interesting time to be there. There was another guy in another city.
They didn't mess with you though.
They did.
Okay.
Yeah. They ended up killing my neighbor. And, cops were like, we think maybe they got the wrong house. So I was leaving town. And then they came, to my door at about 3 o'clock in the morning, but they called me ahead of time, which is, I've always found interesting.
They called you ahead of time.
They called me and I never answer my phone in the middle of the night. And long story there. There's some other strange things around that, but I answer it in perfect English. Your name's Justin. I know where you live. We know what you're doing and we're coming to kill you.
It was nice of them to warn you.
It was really nice of them to warn me. I think the fear, they wanted to.
Yeah.
Hear it's the not fear, rational. Be a part of the fear, and it worked. That they say that there's a bubble of peace that missionaries have. Not true. In the situations like that, I was not sure what to think. But called my friend who was a believer who lived right across from the police station. So I tell him what's going on. They start coming, but before they get there, bang, bang, bang on my door. They rush in. My door was 2 mil aluminum door, or steel door, 2 mil, very thin with a bolt going into a cinder block. So it didn't really keep anybody out. And, so at that time, I had a plan to what I would do in a situation like this. I just was frozen in fear. And they came in, I was upstairs, two rooms and a bathroom. And then they're downstairs and I hear the, cop sirens from about a block away. So they hear them too. They run upstairs, go to the other room. And then I run, get down and my door's on the ground. There's no electricity. This is the middle of the night. So these young cops pull their guns and I come flying. I fell down the stairs. And body and mind were not coordinating too well. And they say, okay, go outside. We're going to go get them. So I go outside and there's four guys within the block with AK-47s. And I see those lights light up and the cops, and there's this big, huge shootout. Eventually they run out of bullets and they shot up four blocks. Al Jazeera came the next day and said, nobody, how did nobody get hit?
Wow.
When they dropped their guns and ran, the only guy who was standing in the middle of the road was one of the believers, and he had this gun that was just, I was shooting with him a couple of days earlier, and it was the worst gun on planet Earth. You could see the bullets go out, leave the gun and go in a different direction every time. So he was standing, I was like, that's probably how four blocks got shot up, because the cops were just doing the Rambo thing, pulling the trigger, fully automatic weapons.
Wow.
They were coming closer to hitting me than the guys down the street were. But, and then the cops, like, God protected you. They come out, they're kissing me on the cheek. You know, we're going to go get them. You're going to put a bullet on their head on Main Street. It's like, I think it's time to go home. So that's what happened. But, I left the country and came back and just, okay, I got to get back there.
Yeah.
I knew that this type of ministry was going to be a part of my life. And I knew that because I was also at this time, I was doing ag stuff, small scale. Mm-hmm. And I had the local authorities' blessing to stay there.
Just taking what you learned on the farm in Kansas and applying it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just after my team left, that was the fears. Like, I'm just this dumb kid. But agriculture allowed me to get the blessing of the community and the authority. So that stuck with me. So I came back immediately and knew that this was going to be a part of my life and wanted to go back to Iraq. Didn't want to get shot at. So I wanted to come in the front door and with an ag business and learn more about that, get some more people around me. And didn't know what I didn't know. So thankfully, God put a girl in my life, who became my wife pretty quickly. And that kind of slowed things down and, started building a team. And one of the team members was, the daughter of, this guy. He ran an organization called Salt International in Grinnell, Iowa. And, he was the president. He was, really good businessman, has a really strong ag company in Iowa and also runs this nonprofit doing ag missions, starting businesses. So that was a perfect fit. He's like, come to Iowa, I'm going to train you and you know, you're going to get my kids killed. We're going to do this right.
Wow.
So we did. And then we, you know, ended up back in Iraq and went in the front door.
Back in the same village or
no,
a different place?
Went to the capital this time. And
is that Erbil?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a good experience for us. We, you know, raised investment and we built a factory that, that would allow us to contract with farmers to grow soybeans. So we financed them with the seed so that they could play on that market. And then we guaranteed purchase and then we processed it and we sold it to the poultry, industry at $200 a ton cheaper than they could get it from America. So that was a good thing for them, good thing for the farmers, good thing for us, as we had access to so many farmers anywhere in Iraq we could go to, with the blessing of the government, highest officials, prime minister. We got to meet him and know him. So it was just a lot different, and that's what we were after. We wanted long-term presence. We wanted to be able to call up people in situations like I was in before and, you know, avoid them as much as possible. And also continue to do church planning work. And we told them whenever we came, we're going to invest, you know, into this company. Here's what we think the local, economy, how it's going to benefit local economy and local farmers. And we're also Christians and that's a big part of our life, and we're going to share our faith. Is that a problem? Nope, not a problem at all. Come on in. How can we help? So that was just very, very different.
Is there a different response, do you think, in the Kurdish areas than there would be in the typical Iraqi areas, or is it very similar?
Very similar. We worked in both.
Okay.
So
it's not as if one group is more responsive than the other necessarily.
No, and through our organization, we're working in all throughout the 1040 window, in ag business and very, very similar, situations.
So what do you think is happening amongst Muslims in the 1040 window? Is you hear different things, like, you know, there's a lot of persecution. There's a lot of people coming to Christ. There's, you hear a whole range of things. What is, from your perspective, what's God doing in that amongst the Muslims in the 1040 window?
Well, I mean, I have a limited perspective.
Well, ours is more limited.
mine's the most.
Yeah, I think one of the things that stands up, is, you know, God was doing something in Iraq during that time. It wasn't anything special that our team was doing. Don't get me wrong on that. God was doing something there. And then also in another country that we're heavily involved, God's doing something right now, with thousands of Muslims coming to the Lord.
Wow.
Through agriculture, but it's more God's doing something there.
Yeah.
And agriculture is a platform that for them, there's when Muslims come to faith, they do face persecution, even in less hostile Muslim countries. But it's more of, you know, your family and your community are going to kick you out, and you're not finding a job is going to be hard. Mm. And a lot of believers in countries like that end up going to another country, especially in Central Asia. They end up going to Russia. Mm. So for church planners, missionaries, they see fruit, but then they end up needing to leave the country just to survive. Mm. And that's a point of frustration. But in agriculture, what we've seen with us, like, here's an example of one project where our ministry partners are kind of like what we were doing in Iraq. They have big operations where they're purchasing grain from farmers and turning it into feed. They're taking local believers and they're sending them to villages with small scale businesses for laying eggs. Everyone knows that they're Christians, but they're business people. So they come in, they're adding this value when they start these small scale egg businesses. They're the cheapest eggs in the village. So there's value there. They're entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So now they're no longer, isolated from community. They're in a position of influence in community. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been the catapult to these 1,000+ new believers in those villages, is believers in position of influence as opposed to outside of the community.
Really what you're describing physically earlier with the soil in a place like Iraq, where it's surprisingly fertile, sounds like spiritually what's going on in a lot of the Middle East and a lot of Muslim communities throughout the 1040 window. You'd think it would just be parched wasteland, and yeah, it turns out that actually the gospel seed is taking root, that soil is a little bit better than people think it would be. What do you see happening even at some of those higher levels of leadership in some of these governments? I mean, you had the Arab Spring, you had so many things going on where everything looked like it was leaning heavier and heavier Islamic, but is there openness to the gospel even at some of those levels?
Yeah. And that'd probably be the second thing, like just trying to put those pieces together of why, why the gospel is moving forward at such a rapid pace in these certain areas, is those areas are either coming off of or in the midst of a lot of tragedy and a lot of war, religious war. People are tired of it. People, whenever they see these atrocities happening in the name of the God that they serve, and it creates this opportunity for, I always describe it as a crack in the surface of the society and these cultures, and it's going to be filled with something. Mm. We've seen in Iraq, believe it or not, in some of the Kurdish areas, we saw that void filled with secularism. We saw the youth drift far away from Islam,
right,
but into something very different. And we also saw where there were people planted, gospel workers. We saw fruit happen in that time as well. Like that story I told about where I was, and there's another guy a couple cities over who was in a very dangerous city, mm-hmm, and on house arrest with his family, and people just started showing up at his door. Southern Baptist guy, like telling me this story. People are showing up at my door knocking and saying, I had a dream, I had a vision, come to this house. Who's the man in white? 10 times it happened. That was 13 years ago. Those 10 guys lead churches in that city today. Mm. So he was there. Like these situations that we see, that void is happening, that crack in that society is happening. What are we going to do about it as the church? How are we going to respond? Mm. Are we going to fill it with good news, or are we going to let people wander in a different direction and find what their idea of good news might be from the West?
Oh, you think historically that's how God's worked in that area anyway. I'm reading through Isaiah right now. You know, there's so much about Babylon and Assyria, you know, countries that empires rather that now, you know, overlap heavily with what we call Iraq.
Yeah.
You have Nebuchadnezzar, who ultimately is seems to be converted and is finally, after multiple, you know, events where he's crossing swords in his life with the one true God, finally surrenders. But God uses these geopolitical things to show people that the gods that they're trusting in are futile and that there's another way and there's a better way. So it shouldn't surprise us as much as it does, but it does really surprise us.
Yeah.
We almost made light of your near-death experience as you were telling your story, but that is a serious thing, and I'm sure, you know, you weren't really laughing during the story, because it's, you know, that's a...
Hard... We made light of it? I don't remember laughing.
Alex did. I see him. He was smirking, making faces at Justin. It's a hard... It's masked by radio, but it was... I was very disappointed in Alex during that time. But when you stop and think about it, I mean, like, none of us like that. You know, none of us want to, like, I would love to be a martyr and have a building named after me somewhere, you know, or that isn't our goal.
And if you do want that,
we don't want you to serve.
Probably an issue.
Yeah.
But it is interesting how God, I'm sorry, not, I don't think God has caused this, but how sin, you know, one of the effects of it is fear that causes Christians to not go into places where there is a ready harvest and they're not, you know, obeying God's call to go into these places. What would your advice be to, you know, a 21-year-old Justin who's on the family farm and hearing, you know, like, if you were to give it back advice to these young men and women who may end up, you know, listening to this podcast, and
this is great. You asked this question on our last episode. What would you say to the 21-year-old?
Yeah,
we should just ask that every guest that we have.
Maybe, you know, what advice would you give to a young person who's going, like, I want to use my life in a way that counts, but I sure don't want to die in Iraq. What would you tell them?
I would say the prompting of the Holy Spirit's real. And when we ignore it, we hear it less and less. So, you know, surround yourself with wise counsel at that age for sure. But also, like, if the Holy Spirit prompts you to do something, and a lot of times for me, like, this equally as scary as going to Iraq was sharing the gospel with this guy that I was sitting on the front porch with. And that was a rational, you know, I was trying to rationalize, I was tongue in cheek, brilliant idea, and had very few of those. and he, you know, sitting there with him, like, just rationalizing that. He, you know, like, well, these other guys are way more open. This doesn't make sense. He could tell his dad, like, but it would have been easy to ignore the Holy Spirit. And I'm really glad I didn't. And so just listen to it. And then, you know, discern it. Is it telling you to do something? You know, what are you hearing? And then, you know, talk to other people if it's a big life decision, but if you're in the moment, follow the Holy Spirit. And then I think, you know, at that age, just do well at what you're sitting out to do. It could be, you know, I didn't think that agriculture was going to be anything exciting for me or anything that I was truly passionate about and align with, you know, what the sacred things, you know, is, you know, we've all heard the separation of secular and sacred.
Right. And you hear that from this imaginary 21-year-old that we're talking to a lot. Oh, well, I don't want to have a normal career, a normal job. I want to go either be a missionary or a pastor or evangelist or something like that. And that can be a dangerous impulse to separate those two parts of life.
Yeah. If you want to do that, be really good at something. We were talking about it a little bit earlier. Like, I couldn't imagine going to a starving village with a backpack full of Bibles like that. I mean, I just couldn't imagine, I couldn't imagine receiving that. I wouldn't receive that message from somebody. So do be good at what you do And if, you know, people, we all have a ministry. Like I say that because I define ministry as work dedicated to God. If you're an engineer, if you're a plumber, like, is it, it's, are you dedicating that work to God? And if the answer is no, then we need to have a conversation. If it's yes, which it should be, then you have a ministry. Mm-hmm. So be a really, really good plumber, be a really good engineer, and see what God, I mean, missions is different now than it was even probably, I mean, post 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, and I think fruit comes from that. I mean, one of the reasons I think, you know, we saw a lot of people come and go on the mission field, and, you know, put yourself in the shoes of your neighbors, you know, here, if you're in your neighborhood and this family from a different country moves in, they don't have a job, but they have money, they have a house, they have food, like, they're spies or they're missionaries. Neither of the two you want to be associated right. with necessarily.
Yeah.
Cause that word, I mean, missionary, we have a definition for it. Mm-hmm. They have a definition for mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. Colonialist invader.
Yeah.
Cultural terrorist.
Yeah. 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 You want to communicate with what your audience, interprets. Mm-hmm. So
how could someone get in touch with you and find out more about what you're doing now and get access to some of the resources you guys are developing? What would be the best way for people to do that?
Probably contact one of you guys.
Okay.
Because I'm part of a organization that